Sometime in the 1990s, you know, as you get older, the decades just kind of blur, you know, a little bit, you know. I can't figure out specifically what year, but in the 90s, I went to the Revue Theater in Toronto on New Year's Day to watch Gone with the Wind on the big screen. I imagine many of you have seen the movie. You know, Rhett Butler, Scarlett O'Hara, Clark Gable, Vivien Leigh. The movie won the 1939 Academy Award for Best Film. And I'd seen it on TV, like probably many of you have, but I wanted to see it on the big screen. I wanted to see it on the big screen, how it was originally made. I wanted to see it all its grandeur. I wanted to see this movie in its epic form. So I traveled down to Toronto, and I got a chance to see Gone with the Wind on the big screen. Now, Gone with the Wind is a long movie. It's like roughly 4 hours. And so it's a marathon. In fact, they broke it into two-hour sections, roughly, with an intermission. And you needed that intermission. And that's how they did it in 1939 when they brought it out. They didn't just show it in one go. They broke it into two sections. But as long as the movie is, it pales in comparison to the book. Gone with the Wind as a book is 1,000 pages long. Like, it's a monster book. It's a truly epic story. It starts right before the American Civil War begins in 1860, and it ends in the early 1870s during the time of Reconstruction. And the movie focuses a lot on the love relationships, what I call the lyrical nature of storytelling, on the personal matters of the heart. But in the book, the love stories don't make up that much a part of the story. They're less important. It's really the grand sweep of history that dominates the storytelling. Gone with the Wind is an epic story. It deals with big events in life, has profound implications for people and how they live their daily lives. There are lyrical dimensions in the story, as I mentioned. There are the love story, the love interests that run through the novel. But you don't need 1,000 pages to write a romance novel. Margaret Mitchell was a serious Civil War historian, so the details in the world of the Deep South are accurate. But more importantly, Mitchell asks us a simple question in Gone with the Wind. It's a question that has implications for us today. How do people created for one world survive when that world is replaced by another? How do people who are created for one civilization survive when their civilization is replaced with another? In Gone with the Wind, the story focuses primarily on a group of elite members of the white aristocracy in the southern states. These elites were created to take part in a world that ran by a certain set of rules. We don't have to agree with those rules, but that's how it functioned in the Deep South back in the 1860s. This world ran by a certain set of rules, and this world was shattered by war and then replaced in the time of Reconstruction. The world operated now on a new set of rules, a completely different set of rules. And how does one survive in that kind of social transformation? How can one flourish when the rules are turned upside down in one's own lifetime? This is not an academic question. It's one that all of us have to deal with, especially as we age. If you live 80 or 90 years, you're almost certainly having to deal with this question that Mitchell raises when she wrote Gone with the Wind. The question she asks us: how does one survive when the rules change in your life? In Gone with the Wind, the social transformation and the rules that go with it happened all within a decade. So it's really fast. It's really fast. That's what makes the story so dramatic. That's what makes it so compelling to read. One world is blown away like the wind. It's just blown away with the wind and replaced by another. That fast, that quickly. It seems like a blink of an eye and the rules change. Now, this doesn't normally happen in life. It usually takes a lot longer for the rules to change, for one world to be replaced by another, and for one set of rules to replace another set of rules. Although it's interesting that we're being forecast that AI might have that same kind of dramatic impact on our lives. We don't know yet. It's too early to tell. But I know people today who are struggling to find a way to survive in this world because the rules that they were operating by no longer operate the same way today. My father's career was in furniture manufacturing. I don't know if you know this, but Ontario was a leading furniture manufacturer at one time. And my father came into his own during a time of flourishing in the furniture manufacturing business industry in Canada, in Ontario especially. He was very successful, but then Canada and U.S. signed a free trade pact in the late 1980s. And one of the consequences of that pact was the complete shattering of the furniture manufacturing industry in Ontario. It was wiped out in a matter of a decade. At the end of his career, he was bouncing from one job to the next, barely scraping by as the industry imploded. And he was having a hard time surviving when the rules changed so quickly for him, just like that. He died at 64 of an aneurysm. I'm 64. He died at my age of an aneurysm. And I'm convinced that one of the contributing factors to his death was that pressure he felt as he tried to struggle to survive in a changing world whose rules he did not fully understand. I know a couple of professional videographers today who have had very successful careers, but who struggle in the midst of the technological revolution to find work. And it all happened within a decade or two. Think of the world in which our 90-plus members were born into. In the, maybe the 1920s, mid-20s, maybe early 1930s. Many of the rules that ran in the world that they were born into have changed along the way. And it's tough to keep up. It's tough to survive emotionally, physically, spiritually, mentally, as the rules keep changing under our feet. How does one do that? That's what Mitchell tries to speak to in Gone with the Wind. And the church is not immune to all the changing rules of the world. Back in the 1960s, and some of you remember this, the church was crammed full of people, but then the sea of faith started to recede. The rules that people worked from started to change. A sea change in our culture took place with respect to faith and religion. Today, many congregations are finding it hard to survive, let alone flourish, in a world that has a whole new set of rules. And this is not unique to Canada. Many Western countries are going through the same thing. 70 years ago, when I was born, Canada was still basically a Christian country. Their stores were closed on Sundays. We said the Lord's Prayer in school. We had Christmas assemblies where the birth of Jesus was mentioned. The culture, in many ways, reinforced for us the basic Christian story. Today, that world's gone. It's been blown away in the wind. Gone with the wind. For better or for worse, our opinion doesn't really matter. It's gone. And the rules that govern our world today have changed, and that means for the church to survive and thrive like it once did, its members and practitioners have to know the story that gives rise to it. Because if you don't know the Christian story, no one else is going to know it. You're not going to have a culture helping you with it anymore. No one's going to know it. If you don't know it, no one's going to know it. And it's our responsibility as Christians to know the Christian story, to know why it matters and how to share it with others. And we've been looking at the Christian story over the past couple of weeks. We're going over the basic Christian story. I've organized it into seven scenes. This is a bare-bones representation of the Christian story, and I've got it on two slides. I put it a bit bigger print so you can see it, actually. Scene one, we looked at that a couple weeks ago. Humanity fires God. We give God the pink slip and tell him we're going to go it alone on earth. We're going to do it ourselves. We're not going to need God anymore. Thank you very much. Scene two, God hires Israel to bring people back home. We looked at that last week. We'll give a quick review of that in a moment. Scene three, we're at scene three today, actually. Israel quits or is fired. Depends on who you talk to. Scene four, God takes up the job himself through Jesus. Scene five, humanity fires God again by crucifying his son to a cross. Scene six, God rehires Jesus by raising him to new life. Scene seven, the church shares the story of Jesus with the world until he returns. That's it. That's the overview of the Christian story. That's the epic Christian story. If you know those seven scenes, you can really, you really got the basic story down pat. I mean, there's a lot of details to fill in with that, but that's the story. 2 weeks ago, as I said, we looked at scene one. It comes from the first chapters of the book of Genesis. We find it in the story of Adam and Eve. The story attempts to answer a foundational human question. Why is the world in such a mess? And the answer, according to the Bible, is because we've refused to collaborate with God as the junior partner. Instead, we have usurped God's role in our life and in the world and replaced God with ourselves. We want to be the senior partner in this operation of life. In fact, in some ways, we prefer to go it alone, God. Thank you very much, but we're going to do it ourselves. And in the biblical account, which forms the basis of the Christian story, this moment of decision is represented by Adam and Eve standing before a fruit tree. Will they agree to collaborate with God and make a world even more beautiful with more wonderful order? Will they trust in God's knowledge of good and evil, or will they seize power by taking the fruit and overthrow God and replace God with themselves? And the answer to the story is they seize power. And they overthrow God and they place themselves in the God position. And it's this choice that's created the world as we see it, according to the Bible. That's the biblical explanation for why the world is the way it is. And it forms the foundation of the Christian story. It forms the foundation of the Christian perspective on life. And last week in scene two, we looked at how God responded to our choice. Because you can't really fire God, as much as you'd like to, perhaps. You can't really fire God. And we looked at last week about how God tries to undo our choice of firing him, to live and operate in the world separate from him. Because God knows how much of a disaster our choice is. And God knows that left to ourselves, our destination, our destiny is not a very promising one. In fact, it will be a disaster for us to try to go it alone from God. See, the breach between God and humanity is, according to the Bible, a colossal disaster and an unfolding tragedy. I was watching a YouTube video recently. It's about how to protect yourself from online scammers. And it was a very interesting program about how little details can be gathered by scammers in order to create a profile on you. But I got thinking about the underlying premise of the video. You have to protect yourself from people today who want to harm you, and they can be from anywhere in the world. It's not just your local neighborhood when you walk down the street maybe at night. You've got to protect yourself from people who live in Russia or China or Ethiopia or Argentina. You've got to be on guard from people all around the world who want to harm you, who want to steal your money, who want to steal your identity. What kind of world is that? Do you want to live in that kind of world? When Sally and I, Elizabeth, my daughter, and I visited South Africa in 2017, it is one of the most gorgeous countries to visit. It's such a beautiful part of the world to visit. But if you have property of any value, you have to build a 12-foot-high wall to protect it. You got to put a 12-foot-high wall around your property in order to protect it. Otherwise, people will break in, they'll steal from you at gunpoint, and they'll likely kill you. What kind of world is that? Do you want to live in that kind of world? We're protected to some degree from that world here in Canada because we built this huge wall around this country. We don't even recognize it, but it's very hard to actually get into Canada. And we have these two large oceans on either side of us that keep the world at bay. And it's also because the ethos of our culture, our culture still rests on Christian values. They still shape our rules today in many ways. God will not abandon us to our self-serving instincts. But at the same time, the breach was caused by our choice, and it will be repaired by our choice too. Now, I could imagine some of you saying, I don't remember making any choice. I don't remember saying to God, I'm going to go it alone. Well, maybe it didn't. But the habit has been passed forwarded to us from previous generations. And we confirm it every day in how we live in the world. We become accustomed to living apart from God, accustomed to not collaborating with God in our daily life, that we don't even know what that means. What does it mean to collaborate God in our daily walk in the world? We just embrace the rules of the world that have been given to us. That's just the way it works. And we try to go it alone in the almost infinite ways that we decide to do so. To undo this choice of going it alone, of trying to do life separate from God, is going to require a decision on our part to return to the collaboration. This is not something God's going to force upon you. God can't force this upon you. Instead, God searches for a tribe or a nation who will voluntarily agree to be his emissary to the world. God chooses to use human beings as a means for our return, because it won't work if it comes directly from God. Eventually, God chooses a people called Israel, and they will be his emissary. Israel was meant to be a kingdom of priests and a holy nation, that is, intermediaries between God and all people. Israel was meant to be a light to the nations who witness God's way through their devotion and way of life. Israel was meant to be stewards of God's truth, who holds fast to God's word and God's laws and represents his character in the world. Israel is meant to be the lineage for the Messiah when God's anointed one comes to bring salvation to the whole world. The story of Israel is about a call to deep collaboration between them and God. The same type of collaboration that was intended for us from the very beginning, the same collaboration that God sought with Adam and Eve at the very beginning. Israel was meant to be the first step in a full collaboration between God and humanity that will ultimately include all people. This collaboration between God and Israel was codified in something called a covenant. A covenant is a solemn promise or a set of promises. Israel promises to collaborate with God by allowing God to assume his first position in their lives. To assume his place in their lives, God promised to use Israel as the exclusive means by which he will bring this collaboration to all people. And when you read the Old Testament, it's about 800 pages long, so it's up there with Gone with the Wind. It's an epic story, and it's mostly about Israel's failure to live out their promises. They just can't carry it through. They just can't do it. They can't yield the God position back to God. They can't make that unique kind of surrender that's required so they can begin their full collaboration with God. It's not that they didn't try. They tried again and again and again and again and again. And each time they still succumbed to the same temptation that was before Adam and Eve as they stood before the fruit tree. Israel stands before the same fruit tree again and again and again. The same fruit tree that Adam and Eve stood before. And the same fruit tree that you and I stand before in our daily walk. The tree might look different each time, but the choice is the same. And they hear the same tempting voice that tells them to seize power and overthrow God. They follow the same instinct that tells them to end this ridiculous call to collaboration and go it alone. And this is what 2 Kings 17 is talking about. Israel as a people failed their unique calling from God. They rejected the sacred collaboration that God offered them. They broke their promises to God, and they became worthless as emissaries of their Creator. Israel imitated the very nations they were meant to lead back to God. There was nothing different about them that could distinguish them from any other people. They were not a holy nation. They were not a light to the nations. They were not stewards of God's truth. They were simply another people who made the same wrong choice and who succumbed to the same temptations that we all do. And the plan of reconciliation that God was attempting to accomplish through Israel, that restoration of a full relationship that God seeks with everyone, that opportunity for full collaboration with God was lost in Israel's fall. And this is scene 3 in the Christian story. Israel quits or is fired. Hard to say which one. Probably more likely fired, but if you read the scriptures, you might come away with the idea that maybe they just quit. Depends how you read the stories in the Old Testament, but either way, it ends up in the same place. God's chosen people find themselves on skid row, and God's great plans of reconciliation end in the garbage heap. And I can almost imagine God, if God had a face, stroking his chin as he sits at the kitchen table drinking his coffee. He has that somber look on his face, that sense of resignation that his plans have failed again. It went horribly wrong, actually. Now what? God was, in a way, back where he started. Well, not quite exactly where he started. Because I think in Israel, he proved once and for all that human beings, that means you and me, left to ourselves, can't do it. We just can't do it. Human beings, for all our greatness, for all our ingenuity and creativity, we just can't manage that special kind of surrender that leads us back into the divine human collaboration. Israel completely failed being a holy nation, completely failed being a light to the nations and stewards of God's truth. But they still had one more important task to fulfill. To be the lineage through which the Messiah, God's anointed one, would be born, a Messiah who would bring salvation to all the world. That promise was still in play. And it's to that promise we turn our attention next Sunday as we explore scene 4 of the Christian story.